Hello and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young joined by Pete Ball, and we are, I was going to say we're just days away from the start of the season, but I guess we're days past the start of the season because there were those two games. And then a news story, just a little thing going on with Shohei Ohtani that we could probably talk about at least a little bit. But today we're getting ready for the start of the season. I know, Pete, you've got another draft coming up. We'll talk a little bit about that. I'm done with my drafts, but I'm trying to figure out how to get some of my rosters in order. So I've got some thoughts on guys I might want, guys I might want to stay away from now. And we've got a bunch of news because now we're getting into the, like, you know, we got it from the Dodgers and the Padres last week with, like, Jackson Merrill is going to be in the lineup for the Padres. But every other team now, we're getting those stories like, this guy made the roster, this guy didn't. It's an interesting time to just talk about sort of what's going on. And I think there's, from a keeper league perspective, a different angle on some of this news than there is in a redraft, right? Like, redraft, guy doesn't make the roster, you might just want to move on. Sometimes they're worth waiting on, but often they're not. In a keeper league, you move on, you're giving up maybe years of value. It's a different dynamic. So we'll talk about some of that as well. But before we get to that, Pete, just how you doing? How's life?
I'm doing well. Like you said, I'm getting ready for my last two drafts tomorrow. One of them is Dynasty. It's just a three-round, kind of round out your roster type deal. The order is done randomly, like that draft that I was talking about last week. But this time, Wyatt Langford, Paul Skeens, guys like that are actually available in addition to Yamamoto and Imanaga. And then I've got a big 16-teamer. But otherwise, I'm good. I coach middle school baseball. Tryouts are next week. We got 70 kids coming out. So when I need Tommy John a month from now, you know it came from this upcoming week. So life's about to get a little busy, but that's all right. We like busy.
Throwing BP.
Yeah, to 70 guys. That's going to be, yeah. I'll be setting some records.
Have fun with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's get the ice ready. Get Dr. Neil, what is it, Elatrache?
Get
him on speed dial. Be ready.
I will.
So we are on episode 130, and I'm looking at jersey number 30, and it's a fascinating number because there's some big names who wore number 30, but the top four guys sorted by WAR who wore this number, like, not one of them is it the number they're associated with. Greg Maddux wore it for 2 years at the tail end of his career with San Diego. Fergie Jenkins wore it for a year with the Phillies. I didn't even know Fergie Jenkins pitched for the Phillies, so that's news to me. Ken Griffey Jr. wore it during his time in Cincinnati, but of course that's not what he's known for. Then you get down to Nolan Ryan, and it's like, oh, he wore it for 12 years, except he's Nolan Ryan. So 12 years is less than half of his career, and it's not the first number I think of him wearing, although maybe it should be, I guess. It probably depends who you're a fan of, because he wore it with the Mets and the Angels. So if you're a Mets fan or an Angels fan, that's probably the number that sticks out for you. Yeah. And then 19 years for Tim Raines. And that's the guy who sort of stands out for me. It also is not his entire career, but it's most of it. There's a few years there in the 90s where he was, I don't know, wearing some other number, but that's the guy who stands out for me. But anyone who stands out for you in terms of that number 30?
Honestly, man, this one kind of makes me feel young because all these dudes are like way past my time watching. I mean, like, I really liked Magaly Ordóñez. He had a pretty good MLB Showdown card when he was with the White Sox, and that Tigers offense, and it was him and Sheffield and a few other guys. That was really fun. So I guess Magaly Ordóñez wearing it for 15 seasons there gets my heart. But I do not feel passionate about the wearers of number 30.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this. And one thing I'm doing real quick right now is I'm just searching for the number 23. Because the way they identify the year is the last two digits. And, like, the best player in terms of career WAR to wear number 30 last year was David Robertson. The actual best player is Kyle Tucker. So Kyle Tucker wears number 30, and that is, there's a legitimate guy who could become an all-time great at this number because it's just not that exciting a number. Yeah, Nathaniel Lowe, Alejandro Kirk, Jake Diekman.
boring.
Jake Berger. I like Jake Berger.
I like burgers.
It's just, it's not a super exciting. I do also like burgers. Not 30 of them, though. But it's not a super exciting number. So I don't know. I almost want to be like, you know what? We're gonna be preemptive and give it to Kyle Tucker on the basis that by the time things are said and done, he'll be near the top of this list. And he may be the guy for number 30 for me. But yeah, otherwise, I guess it's Tim Raines. But and that is not a knock on Tim Raines. Tim Raines is a great player, Hall of Famer. But
sure,
it's shocking how far down this list we had to go to find someone who I was like, no, they actually wore that number. They didn't just like try it on once.
Yeah. Fair enough.
So anyways, let's get into this. And I think before we get into some news and notes and things going on around baseball, you got a draft tomorrow that you pinged me this morning because you were like, I don't know what to do with the beginning of this draft. And it's an interesting question. And it's one I suspect a lot of our listeners in keeper leagues are dealing with, which is, there is no pitching available in your 16-team league. And so you are, the question you basically asked me is like, hey, my first pick, I may be able to take Yordan Alvarez, who is like a obvious first round value. He's going, you know, we all get it. Or I might just have to pass on him to take like Aaron Nola. And this happens in auctions and drafts where like one position is really scarce and it just drives up the price. I don't know if I'm you though, if I really can see myself being like, yep, I'm taking Nola over Alvarez. What are you thinking right now?
Yeah. I mean, it's the internal debate I've had for a while. So, I know I have the fourth pick in the first round and my keepers are Gausman for a third rounder, Gunnar Henderson for a 20th, thank God, and Jose Altuve for a 10th, because if folks remember, you know, last year he started the year with a broken hand, so I got him at a huge discount, and it's paying off. So I've got two bats, and I've got an ace in the fold, and I don't know if you've heard the recent news on Gausman, but it's sounding pretty positive. You know, knock on so many pieces of wood for that, please. I really need Kevin Gausman this season in every single league, TGFBI, this one, you name it. But that's my roster situation. Now, I mean, I'm kind of just doing the math. So obviously I don't have a third round pick, and I know the first two picks on the board are going to be Ohtani and then Freeman. That's pretty much locked in. Those two owners are pretty transparent about what they're going to do. And then it could go anywhere. Yamamoto's available, obviously. And then the other top pitchers are, you know, Pablo Lopez, I guess, separates himself from the pack. I think he's probably going to go third. And if he does, I mean, we're talking about, taking like Aaron Nola, or like you said, or Framber Valdez, which I have no interest, Freddy Peralta, Logan Gilbert. It is a strikeouts per nine league, so guys like Logan Gilbert and Framber Valdez are way worse. Jesus Luzardo, Dylan, like it gets really bad. And I kind of view Nola as like a horse, a little similar, just not as effective as Gausman. You know, you look at the whip from last season and there's still a talented pitcher there. So I'm thinking Nola, because although it would be really hard to pass up Yordan Alvarez or Jose Ramirez, who are both in the draft. And keep in mind, there's no corner infield position, and I already have Gunnar at third. I could move him to shortstop, but you know, I don't want to necessarily tie that up in the first round. But as hard it is to pass up those players, I'm looking at this as simply as, okay, I could have Yordan and like best case scenario, maybe like Dylan Cease. I don't know. Or since pitching gets pushed way up, everybody in this league is panicking about pitching. It's a very busy league where we talk in the chat all the time. Or I could do like Aaron Nola and maybe Corey Seager falls to me. I think Francisco Lindor will be there. You know, like this would be with my second round pick. So I think combining the two, I think I'd rather go pitcher first than hitter, knowing a better hitter will be available. But man, it is it's a really tough call. I've never had such a tough call in this league before, I don't think. And this is year like 16 or something.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way you're thinking about it makes sense. I think the other angle on this is you did mention it's a head to head league. And for me in a head to head league, I start to feel a little more comfortable with the, like, maybe my pitching just won't be that good. Because if you pick a handful of pitchers who like, all right, fine, I'm not going to do well in K per nine. I'm just going to pick, I'm going to get a bunch of pitchers who are low cost relative to their ERA and their whip and everything else, but they're going to be terrible in K-per nine, and I'm just going to lose, like, just punt that category. Or alternatively, I'm going to have, like, I don't know, my CBS league is an example. One of the options I always have is to just carry, like, we have five starting pitcher slots, but it's a daily league. It's like right now in that league, I did not go very heavy on starting pitching and in terms of what I spent my money on. And so let me pull up my roster because I'll actually tell you exactly what is going on with that team. I typically, we have five starting pitcher slots, three relief pitcher spots. I typically go three relievers, five starters, and then we have five bench spots. I usually have two starters on my bench. And so it gives me seven total starting pitchers. Now, right now in this league, I have, I bought Gerrit Cole at auction for $28. He would have gone for 50 easily if he were healthy. And I just decided it was worth taking a shot on him at that price. And I also got a $1 Shane McClanahan, and we haven't had a fab yet. So those guys are still on my roster, but they'll move to the IL as soon as I can get them there, obviously. But the starting pitchers I have are George Kirby, who is a keeper for me, Blake Snell, who is a keeper for me, and Brian Baio, who is a keeper for me. And the other guys I got at auction were Luis Severino, AJ Puck, Louis Varland, and Jared Jones. Let's look at this. I spent $1 on Severino, $4 on Puck, $1 on Varland, $1 on Jones. There are still guys like Trevor Rogers is still out there. Like, I'm gonna fill out that rotation with decent deep sleeper types. But my plan is basically to count on my offense to win me most categories most weeks and to volume my way to a couple pitching categories. And that's enough to win. I don't need to do more than that. And so I'd be tempted in your place, like, I would rather have Yordan than the pitchers you have to take fourth. And I would rather have Lindor or Seager or whichever shortstop is there than the pitchers you have to take there. And maybe you just wait. And now, I don't know, if it's not daily and you don't have the ability to, like, stack a volume play, yeah, I'd be really tempted to be like, my offense is going to be stacked. I won't need a deep bench on offense because my offense will be so good that I won't need to carry a lot of bench bats. And I'm going to use my bench to overload my opponents and bludgeon them to death with my offense, win wins or quality starts, whatever it is that you're doing for that. Win strike. Oh, is it not strikeouts at all? Is it strikeouts per nine as a sixth category? Or is there no?
No. So it's strikeouts per nine and strikeouts. So those guys have a ton of value, and it's quality starts and wins. So, it's 7 by 7.
Go. Like, that's the thing. Go get a bunch of guys. Like, get Framber. Because who cares? So he'll lose you strikeouts per nine, but he'll get you quality starts. He'll get you wins. He pitches enough innings that the strikeout count will be fine, even though the strikeouts per nine won't be very exciting. Like, just go. That would be my approach, is just, like, and maybe Framber's a bad example because maybe you can't get him. Like, he's still, you'd have to give up Yordan or Lindor or whoever. But, like, I'd be real tempted to be like, my pitching is going to come late. It's going to be cheap. I'm going to play certain categories and not others, and that'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm tempted to do it. You know, like I said, Yordan, I was the one that put him back in the draft, and he's kind of been a stalwart for me for so long. And the plan all along was just get Yordan back with the fourth overall pick and start building my outfield, which in a 16-teamer, even though it's only three outfield, can get thin pretty quickly. So I don't think that's a bad idea. I do know that pitching is going to get pushed up so much that second round pick, if I do decide to use it on a bat, could be somebody really, really good, potentially borderline elite. So, yeah, that's where I'm at. Maybe that will be the move I ultimately do. By the time folks hear this, it'll be over. So we'll have to see next week what I ended up doing. But I don't hate that idea for sure.
Yeah. So while we're on the topic of this draft, you said that it was basically a given that Freeman and Otani are going to be the first two picks. Let's briefly talk about Shohei Otani. And what I don't want to do is get into speculating on his legal troubles or what, you know, anything like that. My only question is, if you had the first pick in this draft a week ago, Ohtani, given who you're saying is available, Ohtani would have been a fairly obvious first choice, especially given he has keeper value and all that stuff. How concerned are you? Like, how much have you changed your valuation on him based on the risk of a, again, without getting into too much speculation about what's happening, whatever, like the worst case scenario here with the Shohei Ohtani situation is bad. But, you know, the best case scenario, and I guess, you know, depending on how you define best, the best case scenario for Shohei or for someone who has him on a fantasy team is like, it turns out he really was just a victim here. He did nothing wrong. He still is sort of caught up in a bad situation, and maybe he gets a slap on the wrist suspension because, like, you've just got to be better at protecting yourself than he was. And he did expose the game to some risk. So maybe there's that, but, like, pretty minimal. The worst case scenario is, like, something comes out that he actually, like, this guy was placing bets on his behalf. And then we're really questioning his career. Like, there's a huge range here. Are you downgrading him at all in drafts over the next week because of this?
Yeah, I mean, well, let's start off with a week ago. I mean, in this particular draft, sure, first overall, but I already don't have almost, I don't think I have any Shohei Ohtani shares because I just don't want to plug up util that early. He's obviously worth it. I mean, look, he's tremendous. He's the best player in baseball. Like, I get it. It's just at that point in drafts, I usually want to start chipping away at outfield. So I don't take him. Like I take guys like Aaron Judge and Yordan Alvarez ahead of him. Honestly, I don't know if this is rose colored glasses or what it is. I think I can approach this without any kind of bias because I'm not a Dodgers fan. I have no shares of him in fantasy. This is just kind of how I feel. I just think he's going to be fine. Like I feel like he's so insulated. If he was doing something shady, he clearly has a fall guy. I don't think baseball wants anything to happen here. And the report from, I can't remember if it was Jeff Passan or who it was. I apologize. I don't know who it was. But it was someone legit said they definitely were. He wasn't betting on baseball. And that's talking about his translator. He wasn't betting on baseball. He's betting on other things. So I don't know. Maybe he does get like a, I hate to even throw in a number out there because then it's out there. But maybe he gets some kind of suspension. I don't think it would be for very long because I don't think they can prove much. And I don't really expect them to suspend him. So I feel the same way about Shohei Ohtani now as I did a week ago as a fantasy asset. And that might be short-sighted. That might be misguided. But I have a hard time envisioning this guy, this celebrity going down in flames. It's really hard for me to imagine. So that's where I stand on Ohtani.
Yeah. I can see that. I think I would be a little bit surprised if he escapes this with nothing, just because the perception of it's going to be bad enough. I think they're going to have to act in some way, but I have no idea what, and I don't think I'm meaningfully changing the way I value him either. I think MLB is going to do everything they can to avoid this being more than it needs to be. And so unless there's like real legal stuff that comes of this, and right now it doesn't look like there's going to be, it's a little early to tell, but I'm sort of with you. I think I'm not like staying away from him. I'm not putting a huge discount on him.
No,
I also think there's a good chance that if anything does come up, it's not going to be till much later this year or into next year. By the time the investigation is done and blah, 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 blah. And so at that point, I'm also like, if he's going to miss half of next season, I'll cut him. Fine. If that's what it comes to. So for now, if I had the first pick in this draft and Ohtani was my guy a week ago, he's still my guy now.
Now for anything to happen too, it'd have to be against like his current story, right? Because the story is that this guy was stealing from him and tried to pay off his debts or whatever. And Ohtani was just this innocent victim. And so they're going to have to find something contrary to that to suspend him. Like, I don't think there can be any like, we didn't find anything.
I don't know.
Like a Brady suspension. Like,
I don't know if that's true because I think it almost works the other way, which is there's going to have to be some real corroboration that that's what happened, because the only fact we know right now is that money was transferred from Shohei Ohtani's bank account by somebody who either was Shohei, was acting on Shohei's behalf, or at least was claiming to be Shohei or acting on his behalf. There was money transferred from his account to an illegal bookie. Like, that's the only thing we really know. Everything else is like, the translator said Shohei was just taking care of him, and then all of a sudden the story changed. Like, we have both the translator and a spokesperson for Ohtani on the record saying Ohtani knowingly did this to protect his friend. And then all of a sudden his lawyers were like, whoa. Let's take a step back here. I'm not sure that's what happened. And so I don't know that it's as simple as like, well, they say he's the victim, so he must be the victim unless somebody can prove he's not. I think there's a little bit here of like, there's going to have to be some evidence that he actually is the victim, I think, before this just goes away.
So legally, but MLB, wouldn't they kind of be like, I don't know, if you're Rob Manfred, you're kind of like, yeah, oh man, I'm so sorry. Yeah. Stuff was stolen from you. That's terrible. Enjoy your next game. Like,
I think that'll be fine as long as the legal stuff follows that.
Agreed. Yeah.
Right. Because if what comes out legally is that he agrees to a plea deal to avoid any issues and to help roll up on this bookie, then MLB can't just be like, I don't know. Right. Maybe they can get away with like, it's a plea deal, but we don't know what he pled to. And based on what we found, there's lots of paths here. And that's, again, we're now starting to speculate on the thing I didn't want to speculate on too much. I think there's a lot of paths open. If you are interested in speculation and sort of Craig Calcaterra has a really good write-up of this. And I think Craig was a lawyer or is a lawyer. So he actually like gets this. Nate Silver has a good write-up where he also cites Calcaterra's write-up. So like, there's a bunch of good content out there if you're actually interested in like, what are the different paths for it? How could this play out? And I will say, like, they both think there's real risk here for Ohtani. I don't know. We'll see how it plays out. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll not talk about that anymore. All right. Welcome back. Now that we're done with that topic, let's talk a little bit about some of the interesting or exciting, or in some cases, disappointing news. And Pete, what I want to do here is sort of go through a bunch of guys who have either made a team or not made a team, and discuss what this does to their value. And I think this is, you know, I mentioned at the beginning, like, this is an interesting topic because in keeper leagues, these are different trade-offs than you're making in redraft, right? So like, a guy might miss the team in redraft and be an easy cut because, hey, if he's not on the team, he's not on the team and he's not doing you any good. And you can live with the risk of letting him go. That's a harder choice to make in a keeper league where that same guy might be on your team for years if you hold on to him. Alternatively, a guy might make the team in redraft, and in redraft, you're like, let me see what he does before I go pick him up. Whereas in a keeper league, you might be like, this is my opportunity to buy and I need to buy now. So let's start with... the Miami Marlins. And there's really two names that are kind of interesting here that both made the roster that are just, on top of anything else, just good stories because these guys have had a long road back. And it's Sixto Sanchez and Max Meyer. And like, Sixto working out of the pen, Meyer's going to be the fifth starter. Are you jumping at either of these guys? Are you looking at like interesting long-term upside from these guys or no?
No on Sixto, not yet anyway. Definitely fun prospect when he was a prospect, and you know, he's the return for JT Realmuto, and there was a time where we were pretty excited about Sixto Sanchez. I don't know if you saw those pictures. He looked woefully out of shape, and you know, I don't want to spread that kind of garbage, but like, I that guy has a lot to show before I'm ready to buy back in. Max Meyer, on the other hand, you know, that was a pretty straightforward situation. Max Meyer, correct me if I'm wrong, Chad, that was Tommy John surgery, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So pitchers have come back from that. This is a guy who is an absolute top prospect. We've seen him now. He's thrown seven innings in spring training. I don't think he's given up a run. Yeah, he hasn't given up a run in spring training. It's useless to dissect seven innings, but in those seven innings, only one walk. So like that's really promising. And this was a former top prospect. So, you know, it's unfortunate circumstances that he's getting a shot here because there's been so many injuries to the Marlins, and you can't help but feel for Marlins fans. But this to me is just a elite prospect who all of a sudden has some runway to take a shot here. Sixto Sanchez coming out of the bullpen. Like I that doesn't do a lot for me. I know Tanner Scott had a really brutal spring training, but I don't even know. I don't think Sixto would be next in line or next in line after that to see save chances. So until I hear that Sixto Sanchez is pitching effectively and getting a spot in the rotation, I'm a no. Max Meyer, though, yeah, he's moving up my boards for sure.
Yeah, I generally agree. I mean, Meyer has been on my radar. Like in auto new leagues, I've already been interested in him because he's actually the kind of guy who, like, if he hadn't made the roster, I don't know what I would have done. And we're going to talk about a guy sort of like that in a minute. But I was at least going to consider sitting on him for a little while to see if and when he got a shot. But now that he's in there, he's in there. I think with Sixto, I mean, looking at the Marlins bullpen. So let's start with this. Tanner Scott's the closer. Obviously the closer. He was good enough last year that he has that job. He will keep that job at least for now. But like you said, spring, I mean, saying he had a bad spring, like he has an 8.31 strikeout per nine, which is not good for a guy who was over 12 or at 12, actually exactly at 12 last year and over 12 the year before. He is walking 14.54 per nine innings. Now, per nine innings, he has thrown a grand total of 4 1/3 innings.
That's still so bad. Oh my God.
But he's made seven appearances, right? And he's only thrown 4 1/3 innings.
He has
large part because he walks guys like constantly. And so it is ugly for him. And look, spring training is spring training. Maybe he's out there working on something and he'll be fine. But like if he's not, and Sixto is dealing because he's looked pretty good in spring, right? Well, he has a zero ERA. He's not striking anybody out though. So maybe I take that back. But the point I was going to make is that the guys behind Tanner Scott are Andrew Nardi, Anthony Bender, George Soriano, Sixto Sanchez, Anthony Maldonado, Declan Cronin, and Brian Hoying, according to Roster Resource. Now, there may be some names in or out of there. It's not a really like, there's not somebody obvious to step up behind Scott if Scott loses his grip on that role. And Sanchez is the kind of guy who, given all the injury issues he's had and all the history he's had and all the problems that have gone in with him, if he goes into the bullpen and he's pitching well and they need him to step in at closer and he does that job effectively, he is exactly the kind of guy who they might be like, you know what? We are washing our hands of his future as a starter. He is our closer. He's good to, like, you just, it's almost the kind of thing. It's like, if he starts being an effective closer, I don't know why they would ever mess with that because you just run so much risk with him. And so I'm watching him, especially in my like 5x5 keepers or any keepers where saves matter, because he is the kind of guy that if you start to hear hints, if we get to late April and Scott looks terrible and Sixto looks great and you get the like vote of confidence from the manager, like, oh, Tanner's our guy, we're not making a change yet kind of thing. Then you start thinking like, okay, well, not making a change yet. When are they going to? And Sixto becomes the kind of guy that if you get in cheap, you could be sitting on him for years as a closer if he settles into that job. So whereas the other guys in this bullpen, like, I don't think that's true for Nardi or Bender or Soriano. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm shortchanging them. But he's the one who I could see, like, just establishing himself as a long-term closer if he can stay healthy and succeed and get the job. There's a lot of ifs. And so I'm not picking him up today, but I'm watching him because of that.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that exact story playing out. And I mean, that's kind of what played out for AJ Puck, and now we see him back in the rotation. So it could be a long redemption arc here for Sixto Sanchez. But I think you hit the nail on the head at the end there. There's nothing really to do right now. If you start hearing those things, there's a lot of dominoes that need to fall for Sixto to do that.
Yeah. Let's jump to Detroit, because I mentioned that we were going to talk about someone that in my mind is a little bit like Meyer, but didn't make the rotation. That's Matt Manning. Now, calling him a little bit like Meyer might be, I don't know. I would guess, I shouldn't put words in people's mouths. I would guess most of our listeners would prefer Meyer, even if they'd both made the rotation, if you had to pick one or the other. But Manning has had a good spring. At times, we have talked about him on this show that like he gave up those home runs, but they were sort of cheapies. The strikeouts were decent, and they've stayed decent. The walk rate isn't bad. The home runs have become a worse problem since we last talked about him, and that is, I suspect, why he's not on the major league roster. But he's an intriguing guy. He's a prospect, or was a prospect with some pedigree like Meyer. He hasn't really hit his stride, but he had mid-threes ERAs the last 2 years in a total of 27 starts. Like, he's a fairly interesting pitcher, but he's not in the rotation. And I think I'm just cutting my Matt Mannings.
Yeah, it's a tough one. So Sawyer Gibson Long is out with a groin strain. And if he's back before there's any kind of injury or issue with the current Tigers rotation, I don't know if Manning gets the next call, which could be interesting to see. But long story short, I agree. I mean, it depends on the depth of my league. If I have a $1 Matt Manning in an Otten league, I'm holding on. I'm not going to cut him. But if it's any kind of like 12-team, 15-team, one of those rotos, I don't see how you continue to roster him, because something needs to happen for something to change. Because if he pitches lights out and just sort of continues the spring that he's having at AAA, there's still not a spot in the rotation for him. It's actually kind of a pretty good rotation. Like Jack Flaherty's, dare I say his name again, pitched really well this spring, and he's got his velocity back, 97 miles an hour. It's great to see, even though he says he doesn't need velocity. We'll see if that's true this year. So there's not a spot for him. So yeah, I'd be interested in cutting him. And I don't know if you said this, Chad, but didn't he have, and Fangraphs has been like crashing for me lately, but didn't Matt Manning have, I got it working now, some home run issues this spring? Yeah, he did. He gave up.
He's given up 6 home runs in 16 innings.
Yeah, whoops.
That's not just home run issues. He's given up a lot of home runs.
That is Tanner Scott walk level issues this spring. So, I mean, granted, I think one of them had an expected batting average of like 120. I can't remember who was the hitter, but like, sure, there might have been a little bit of bad luck there. But it's no surprise he didn't make the rotation outright, given the history that he's had, the disappointments that he's had, and the fact that Tigers rotation is pretty good. So if you are holding on, know that there still might be some issues. This spring has not like resurrected his former prospect glory. And if you are cutting, I totally understand that.
Yeah, I think for me, even in my auto new leagues, there's just enough interesting guys out there who I'm going to learn stuff about sooner. So in the staff league, the Fangraph staff league that you and I both play in, Niv and I just picked up JP Sears. Mm. We picked him up for $1 in that league. I would much rather go pick up JP Sears right now than Matt Manning. Because at the very least, Sears is going to be pitching and I will get to learn something about what he's capable of. And Manning just isn't enough of an upside play to me to want to confidently sit on him, right? Like, another guy not in the Tigers rotation is Jackson Jobe. I'll sit on him. I'll wait and see, right? He has the upside. Like, he wasn't going to make the rotation. You were picking him up as a prospect anyways, but even if you had some hope he was going to, you can wait on him, because the potential for him to be an elite starter is huge. I just don't see that with Manning. And so I'm just not interested in waiting around. I'd rather gamble on Jared Jones, Joe Boyle, JP Sears, Max Meyer, like someone like that who's actually in the rotation. Even if I like Manning more than them in a vacuum, I'd rather go with those guys now.
Yeah, to revisit last week's conversation, both Tanner Houck and Garrett Whitlock have made the Red Sox rotation. I would definitely take both of those over Matt Manning as well. So you're right. There's got to be somebody out there more interesting than Manning, especially given those home run troubles in the spring.
Yeah. So let's switch to maybe the top prospect in baseball. I think it depends who you ask, but it's certainly among the top prospects in baseball, and that is Jackson Holliday. Jackson Holliday, not in the Orioles lineup or roster. I don't think there is a question here that if you have Holliday, you're waiting. If your reaction was, oh, he didn't make the team, I better cut him. Call me, because I'll trade for him. Even if I'm not in your league, I'll take him off your hands. I'll figure out a way. I will join your league to get him from you. However, I think the big question with him is, when do we see him? And you know, the thing that comes to mind with me is, like, when these guys go down, you always get, you know, it's always this service time. If he stays down for 2 weeks, then they get an extra year of service time. And we often hear in those cases, like, oh, they got to work on their defense. They're making this change. And we're getting some of that with Holliday, because he is going to have to learn a new position. And Mike Elias, their GM, is he the GM, president of baseball, whatever his role is, did say, he needs to work on this transition. We want him ready to play when he comes up, blah, 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 blah. They also talked about his ability to hit left-handed pitching. Not so much to hit left-handed pitching. They're talking about the opportunity to just face high-quality left-handed pitching. And while that does sound like the kind of thing you could say about any young left-handed hitter, I got a tweet here from the Jacob Calvin Meyer, Orioles reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He is noting that Jackson Holliday had 15 plate appearances versus lefties in spring training. This is yesterday, so I don't know if he's had more. Sorry. But he's had 15 plate appearances versus left-handed pitchers. He struck out in 9 of the 15 plate appearances. And I think one thing we forget about Jackson Holliday, because he's looked so good and he's so exciting, is he has a grand total of 255 plate appearances above A-ball. So he is still super young. I mean, he's like 20, right? He's super young. He's super inexperienced. And he actually hasn't faced very much quality left-handed pitching. And so while this sounds at first glance like, oh, he needs to work on second base and hitting lefties. And, like, that's the thing we say about all young players coming up, so that we can justify holding them down. He actually has a problem he needs to address, or at least a box he needs to check. And based on his spring training, I'm not sure how easy that's going to be. And I don't think that the Orioles are going to rush him if they think he's still a platoon guy. Like, if they don't think they can slot him into the lineup against lefties when he's up, I don't think they're going to call him up. And so I'm starting to wonder, like, I wonder if it could be a couple months.
Yeah, I don't expect it to be quite that long. I think the need will be there. I do kind of reject the immediate, like, gut reaction that people tend to have with teams who don't call up their elite prospects right away, because our minds naturally go to the evil, like, just hold them down to get the extra year of control. And look, that is very important, and that is an organization looking out for themselves in a lot of cases. But you're right.
Yeah.
Most of the time, it's that these guys actually do have things to work on. There's a reason why elite prospects often get called up and fall flat on their face, right? I think back to Alex Bregman when he very first debuted. You could look at Mike Trout's first month in the major leagues. You could look at as recent as Ellie De La Cruz, who looked like he could not be stopped, and he got called up and immediately started hitting. And how did he finish? Right. So, like, it's not a slam dunk, like, oh, elite prospect and he looks pretty good, so he's got to start playing right now or you're being cheap. It's not that simple. And I think in the case of the Orioles, they have a pretty strong defense here. I mean, you brought up the strikeout rate against lefties. How about just the strikeout rate this spring? 33%. I mean, that's exorbitant. And so he doesn't profile as somebody who's going to have a bad strikeout rate. Like, he just doesn't. I would expect that to come down tremendously. It did throughout the minor leagues. The highest he posted was 20.8%, even though, like you said, it's a small sample throughout the minor leagues. The Orioles have a lot of depth, it seems, not just in the farm system, but at the major league level. This does make it much more likely that Colton Cowser is going to make the major league roster. Not that they play the same position, but there's only so many spots, and he's earned it this spring. Mm-hmm. So I know this is meant to be about Holiday and his fantasy value and stuff like that, but just the process of it, I totally understand what the Orioles are doing here. And for Holiday himself, I still do expect, because he is so talented, that he will figure this out. He will make his debut sooner rather than later. I don't think his fantasy value in keeper leagues, to me, his fantasy value hasn't changed at all. In redraft, certainly, if you took him, you know, in the first 10, 12 rounds, you're probably regretting it right now. But if you have space to store him and he does get called up by the end of April, I don't think you're going to regret it, because I think he's that talented. So it's just kind of a tough position to put managers in. But I'm still super excited about the player.
Yeah, I think the thing with the timing on him is, now, if you look at their lineup and where they potentially could open up time. So they are talking about him working on second base. Jordan Westberg appears to be the starting second baseman, with Ramon Urias at third. Those are the two guys he could theoretically replace. However, there is another prospect that also had a great spring for the Orioles in Kobe Mayo, who may be just as deserving of that next shot and also plays third base. They have Connor Norby, who is an interesting prospect who may deserve a shot and may be ahead of Holiday in terms of timeline, who plays second base. And then if you have just like room for a bat in general, you've got Heston Kjerstad and Kyle Stowers, who are both still sort of interesting and could play. They aren't infielders, and so they don't help. They can't play second or third if that's the spot that opens up. But if it's an outfield spot, a DH spot, something like that, or a bench bat spot, those guys are probably ahead of him, and they're on the 40-man roster, and Holiday, Mayo, and Norby are not. So I think there's just a bunch of stuff going on around this that's like, keeping him down to start the year makes sense. He's got a real thing he has to work on, and he's now in a clump of maybe five other dudes who may be ahead of him, maybe aren't. There's going to be reasons they should be, reasons they shouldn't be. And so I just think it could be a little longer than people are expecting. And I do think, like, in a keeper league, the big question for you is not, do you keep him, do you cut him, whatever. The big question is, how hard do I have to work to find a replacement to feel good about that position short term? And I do think you should figure you've got to fill that spot for a couple months. If it ends up being less than that, great. But I think you should plan on that. In redraft, I think your big risk is like, yeah, if he's up by the end of April, fantastic. But if you sit on him till the end of April and he's not hitting lefties at all, and they've called up Mayo and Mayo is crushing, And Westberg's doing fine at second, and there's suddenly not room, like, then that timeline starts to extend, right? Then it gets worse. And so I think in redraft, you do have to think about, like, I'll say this, in a redraft league, I'd be shopping him in trades. I'm not ready to cut him. But if I could get somebody who's like, yeah, I'll trade you for 5 months of Jackson Holiday, I might take that trade if I can get a good 5 months of Holiday value. Because I don't think it's a given you're going to get 5 months of Holiday this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to all depend on how he starts out in the minor leagues this season. Because he is the type of prospect where if he's just lighting it up like he has really throughout the minor leagues, that no matter what the current situation is, he's going to get called up. It's Jackson Holiday, right? Number one overall pick, all that stuff. I think he could elbow his way. Even if those other two, particularly Norby and Mayo, I mean by those other two, are performing almost as well, I think Holiday can elbow his way to the front of that line. But, you know, you brought up an interesting thing with the lack of plate appearances in the upper minors for Jackson Holiday. Kobe Mayo has about three times as many plate appearances at the upper minors than Jackson Holiday, and Connor Norby has about four times as much. So those dudes are, you know, knocking on the door, like you said. And I wouldn't be shocked if they got the call before him, but he is the type of prospect. Yeah. He'll elbow his way to the front.
And Mayo, for what it's worth, he crushed AA and AAA as a 21-year-old last year. Mm-hmm. And he is not Jackson Holiday level prospect. He's like a good top 20 prospect, right? He's not far behind. And so I don't know. I think if the organization, and I don't know what the organization thinks, I don't know what they want, I don't know what they'll need. If they think the spot is there that Mayo can fill first, I think he might be next in line. So
there's also just the reality.
We'll have to see how that plays out.
Jordan Westberg plays well like that. That is a potential outcome here. He's a top 100, top 75, might have been even have been top 50 right before he got called up prospect. So it wouldn't surprise me if he just hits and makes things that much more challenging.
Well, and that gets to another team that in that same division, who I think is worth talking about, which is the Tampa Bay Rays. It sounds like Junior Caminero has no shot to make the roster, even with they had an injury to Jonathan Aranda that theoretically could open up time for someone. But it doesn't sound like it's going to be Caminero. And there's been some questions about like, what's really holding him back? But they don't seem to believe he's a shortstop. They've been trying him at third base mostly. And Itzhak Paredes was a really good third baseman last year. And then maybe you can move him to second base, but Brandon Lau is, you know, as much as he was down last year, he's not moving anywhere. I'm sort of curious what you think Caminero's path forward is, given the situation on the Rays, because I mean, the Rays are like, man, they're sort of, they've got so many random parts moving around and they love their platoons. They've got all these like plans set up, and Caminero is, you know, he's 20 years old. He's not having a particularly good spring. He got a cup of coffee last year and was not good at all in that cup of coffee. That also means, by the way, that this isn't just a service time thing for a couple weeks, because his service time already started at the end of last year, which means that it's probably more like 3 to 4 weeks for a minimum service time stay for him, if that's what this is. And so I don't think that's what it is. And so I'm sort of like, I'm getting the same vibe here, where I think a lot of people are expecting Caminero soon, and I'm just not so sure.
Yeah, I think it all depends on if the bottom falls out for Itzhak Paredes. You know, listening to FBT on CBS, and I can't remember which of the hosts was talking about it, but I mean, he's so pull fly ball reliant. I mean, there's no exit velocity there. I mean, it feels like last season was like a best case scenario for him. And so if he's just a little worse than he was last season, like, could that open up an opportunity for Caminero? Yes, but he has to perform well with this minor league stint to actually get that spot. I do think it says something about how the Rays, view Caminero. They're normally so slow with their prospects that it's painful that he did debut last year. Like, I actually take that, even if he performed not that great or bad, I take that as a good sign than a bad sign, because the Rays with prospects can be brutal. I mean, I think this is actually a very different conversation if he had never debuted and he was just still in the minor leagues. I take his debut as actually a good thing, even if the performance wasn't there. So in terms of when to expect him, like, sort of like Holiday, it depends on how those guys in front of him perform. And I do think there is bottoming out potential, not just for Itzhak Paredes, but with so many of those Rays bats. This is a team that is constantly in contention. That offense sucks. I mean, it just does, especially if Josh Lowe is still hurt, starts the year in the IL. I don't know where that story is or where that's at. I think last I heard, he's actually close to returning. Or maybe he already has. I don't know. Even with him, though, look at him. That's a player who's had one good season, and it feels like he's their best hitter. So I have concerns about the Rays offense, and I think if they start the year poorly, they're going to look for help. And what better place to look than one of the top prospects in baseball whose exit velocities rival like O'Neill Cruz and Aaron Judge's. I mean, at some point, regardless of the surface numbers, they may just say, let's give this kid a shot and see where it goes. It's the Rays. I don't trust them, but that's kind of where I'm at with Caminero. I think it might be sooner rather than later, because I just don't trust that offense.
Yeah, I do think with Paredes, and I get the concern about the bottom falling out. Yes, he is very pulled fly ball dependent. However, he was sixth in baseball in the number of pulled balls in the air, line drives and fly balls to the pull side last year. And here's a list of other guys who pull a lot of fly balls. Marcus Semien led baseball in that category last year. Second was Jose Ramirez. Third, Mookie Betts. Fourth, Ozzie Albies. Fifth, Nolan Arenado. Paredes is sixth. Then Kyle Tucker, Francisco Lindor, Cal Raleigh, and Spencer Torkelson is 10th. That group, and you can ask some questions about Torkelson. He's still working his way up, but I think you and I are both high on him, so I feel good about this. That's a group of hitters that hit the ball, right? Like, that is good company to be in. And so I think the question with Paredes is not like, oh, he's so fly ball. It's just, do you believe that's a skill? Do you think that's a skill? And if you think that that's a skill, if you think the ability to get out in front of a ball and lift it and pull it is a skill, then I don't think I have a lot of concerns about Paredes. Because I mean, you want to go back to the year before, number one, two, and three in that category, Arenado, Ramirez, Simeon. Santander, who was 11th last year, was 5th. Mookie Betts, 6th. Like, there's a lot of guys. Kyle Tucker's 12th the year before. So, like, it's the same guys, right? Year after year, who turn on the ball in the air repeatedly. And it is a skill that drives production.
Even then, it still feels like last year, like, I just, him as a 31 homer hitter. I just can't buy that. And so if you knock that number and everything else stays the same, like even with everything going right, he had a 92 WRC plus last season. Like, I just don't think he's a good hitter. So it might be a skill and he maybe can maximize that. But I think we saw it at his absolute best last season.
He has a 92 WRC plus in spring. He had a 137 last season.
Oh, okay. I'm looking at spring.
He was legitimately great last year.
Even still,
I mean, the year before, like,
if it was a 92 WRC plus, I think I'd be completely, completely out. So I'm glad I was looking at the wrong thing there.
We're still talking about a guy since he came to Tampa, has had nearly 1,000 plate appearances with a 128 WRC plus. He had a 116 in 2022 in another almost 400 plate appearances. So this is not like it was a 1 year. Oh, he put everything together. Like, this is, he's now done this 2 straight years where the xWOBA doesn't look that great because he doesn't hit the ball as hard as you'd like, but everything else fits because of where he hits the ball. So I'm willing to buy in on it. I've got Paredes in lots of rosters, and I'm very happy with him because I think that he brings a skill to the table that, like, maybe this is just because as a Cleveland fan, I've watched Jose Ramirez for years, and this is Ramirez's skill set. This is what Jose Ramirez does. Like, if you look at Jose Ramirez over the years, he does not hit the ball. He hits a little harder than Paredes, but he does not hit the ball as hard as people expect him to. He's just so good at hitting, getting out in front and just crushing balls to the pole side. It's the same skill set. So that's what I'm banking on.
Even Ramirez, like, I know you said he hits the ball harder. He hits the ball a lot harder. I mean, 86 mile an hour exit velocity for Isak Paredes. I can't imagine him having a repeat season of what he did last year.
Yeah. We will see. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll see if there's any other news and notes we want to cover before we go. All right. Welcome back. We've covered a handful of interesting call-ups and non-call-ups, guys who aren't going to make rosters. Pete, anyone that we haven't talked about that you're like, oh, we should talk about this guy too?
I don't know if he needs to be talked about, but Sadon Rafael had a great spring. He might gain second base eligibility.
They officially announced him today, right?
They did. Yeah, so he's made the roster. He might gain second base eligibility because of the Vaughn Grissom injury. So there's, I think, definitely in your categories league, he'll deserve some consideration, particularly the five outfield ones, because he could be quite a stolen base contributor. There's a lot of concerns about his swing selection, especially after he got called up last season. Those concerns came to reality. But he has shown a lot of progress this spring with the swing selection. Outside of my hometown Red Sox, I'm trying to think if there have been any kind of surprises. Not really. We do have the news that Wyatt Langford has made the Rangers. I don't find that particularly surprising. Obviously, he's a
big Rangers news.
Grab now.
Yeah, for sure. And the big Rangers news is that Corey Seager is in the lineup literally right now.
Huge.
He is playing baseball. So we're recording on Sunday afternoon. And as of this moment, oh, I was wrong. He was pulled out of the game. Not in a bad way. He got 2 plate appearances. He went 2 for 2 with 2 singles. And I suspect, given this is his first action, that he's just, you know, taking the rest of the afternoon off. But that would seem to make him a lock for being ready for opening day. Although I suppose the argument against that is, the Mets signed JD Martinez, and he's going to start the year in the minors. Did you see that?
I didn't see. I mean, that one is definitely like a week, get your feet under you, you're an older guy.
Well, it's a minimum of 10 days, right? Because it's when you option a guy, they've got to be down for 10 days. So it's going to be a little more than a week.
I'm going to guess I find that by the 11th day, weird. He's a Met.
I would think so. I just find the whole thing very strange because, like, I don't know. JD Martinez couldn't find somewhere to go, like, face some live pitching for the last few months while he got ready. Like, something about it feels off to me because I would have expected him to be the kind of guy who's like, it's not like he needs to learn a playbook. Like, he doesn't, like, just go up, hit the ball. He could do that. So I don't know. It feels really weird to me. I don't understand why they're doing it. They say he needs to build up with minor league at bats and, like, I don't know. They're talking about him like he's a starting pitcher who needs to, like, work up to a full starter's workload or something. It's like, dude, he's a DH. He can go take 4 to 5 plate appearances a game. He should be ready. So I'm just very perplexed by this news, but I'm sure you're right. I'm sure it's nothing.
At this point in the draft season where he's been going in drafts before the Met signing, like, I think some assumption that he wasn't going to play 162 this year, which he's not going to do anyway. I mean, he didn't even come close to that last season, despite the great production, was already kind of baked into the cost. So I would fully expect after 10 days, unless he suffers some kind of setback, that JD Martinez will be with the Mets. And I think this is a great move for him. I thought it was interesting how candid he was about why he didn't sign with the Giants. He's like, I can't hit there, and I'm going to hit 260 with 20 homers, and everybody's going to say I'm washed up and I'm not going to get another deal. I'm kind of putting words in his mouth about the deal part, but that first part is pretty much exactly what he said. And I do find that kind of interesting. I mean, we should assume the players feel the same way about we do when it comes to numbers and, you know, what ballparks are good, what aren't. But he was very much against the Giants. And so decided to go to the Mets instead, where, I don't know, I feel a lot better about that lineup now. Well, I will after the first 10 days of the season. So good move for the Mets. Good move for JD. Although I don't expect much from the Mets this season. That should be a fun season for him.
Yeah, I think the thing there's a couple of things I find a little strange about it. One is about what you were just talking about. One is it's not like Citi Field is some great park for him. It's a, per Baseball Savant, it's a 95 park factor for home runs for right-handed hitters. That puts it 21st in baseball. Now, that is better than Oracle, which is an 83 park factor and is 27th in baseball, but it's not like he went to a power park. And he made a bunch of comments about being quote-unquote addicted to the playoffs. He went to the Mets because he's addicted to the playoffs. And I'm like,
that reminds
really?
Me of Jason Bay so much.
That's why you're there? Because I will tell you right now, if I had to pick a team to make the playoffs between the Giants and the Mets, I think there's a good chance they both miss.
Yeah, I was going to say,
if I was picking one, but I had to pick one, I would take the Giants. I think they're the better team of the two. So I don't know. We'll see. I personally think he's putting a lot of spin on stuff. I think mostly what happened was he got a offer from the Giants. He wanted more. He countered for more. Because that's what we're told, right? He didn't turn them down. He countered, which is a form of turning down. And they were like, no, 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 you're not worth that. And he eventually came to realize that they were right and he was wrong. And I think he's telling a lot of other stories to avoid the truth, which is he thought he'd get more money than he did. And he's not. And so this is what he was left with. So
I mean, for him personally, I could see that. But if he signed with the Giants, I don't think I have any interest. Whereas with the Mets, I do. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's not that much of a difference. But San Francisco, I think he's right. I think it's a bad place to hit. I think hitters know that. And whether he has some other reason to feel that way or not, he might. But in this instance, I kind of take him at his word for at least the point he's making, where, like, it's a pit. I wouldn't want to hit there either.
Yeah, that's totally fair. So trying to see if there's any other interesting news. I mean, my hometown Guardians placing Miles Straw on waivers, which is not really news in and of itself, except that it does potentially open up a 40-man spot which makes things a little easier for them when it comes to keeping Davis and De Los Santos and to eventually adding Chase DeLauter to the roster, which in my opinion, they should be doing right now. They're not going to, he's not coming up today. But they do have to find a way at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later, especially if Cleveland has any hope of making the playoffs, to make room for both DeLauter and Manzardo. And neither of those guys are on the 40 man right now. And so I do find it interesting that they are already finding ways to clear 40 man spots. And it's a 40 man spot they don't really need. They're just moving on from Straw. And it's like, it creates a really interesting question with making room for both DeLauter and Manzardo when it's time. So I think for me, I'm a little bit higher on those two guys than I was before that news, only because I think that their timelines may have moved up a bit. If the Guardians are truly not committed to Straw and they're going to move on from guys like that, it changes the dynamics of how much room there will be when these guys are ready. So,
yeah, I expect to see Manzardo pretty soon. DeLauter, I think if he didn't have this spring, this ridiculous, crazy spring where he has no flaws in his game, then I don't think we'd be seeing him for a while. I know he's dealt with injuries, 28 plate appearances at AA, and that's it. Nothing at AAA, obviously. So he's kind of played his way into some consideration. And one quick last point on JD Martinez, because I looked it up. I was like, I wonder what the expected home runs by Park were last season. San Francisco would have been his worst. He would have only hit 24 homers last season. And he would have hit, if he played all his games at Citi Field, 39 home runs last year. So that's a difference of 15.
That's interesting.
If he saw that number, I'm not surprised in his comments. But that's, again,
fair enough.
That's a expected number, that whatever.
Yeah. On DeLauter, for what it's worth, the spring has obviously massively improved his profile sort of nationally with fantasy players, stuff like that. But I just wrote about him on Fangraphs the other day because I was writing about the players I roster most in Auto New. One of whom is JP Sears, who I now have on literally all seven of my teams. So JP Sears better be good. The other is Chase DeLauter, who I have on five of my seven teams. And I noted in there that, just read some numbers here. Since the start of the 2023 season, right? Which he missed some time, but then he got healthy. So basically, since he got healthy, he's had 351 plate appearances between the Complex League when he first came back and was getting his feet wet, High A, a call up to Double A, the Fall League, and spring training. Okay, so a bunch of plate appearances against what's mostly sort of Double A-ish level talent, maybe a little higher, maybe a little lower, depending on where you are. He has, in those 351 plate appearances, 45 strikeouts, which is a 12.8% strikeout rate, and 42 walks, which is a 12% walk rate. And he has 14 home runs and 28 doubles over that stretch, which is on pace over a full season for something like 24 home runs and 48 doubles over 600 plate appearances. Now, he's doing this against Double A, right? But here are the list of major league players who had a combined 72 extra base hits or more last year. Olson, Freeman, Acuna, Otani, Betts, Robert, Riley, Seager, and Simeon. Of that group, Acuna is the only one who had a double-digit walk rate and a strikeout rate under 15%. Now, DeLauter did this again in the minors, right? This is not a like apples-to-apples comparison by any means. But that type of 350 plate appearances across all those levels, like, he put up truly elite special numbers for a full year now. And so I think that people were sort of sleeping on him because of the injuries, and he's got this like sort of funky swing. And so a lot of scouts are like, oh, I don't know if the swing is going to hold up, but like, I think there's a really special talent here. And I think what happened in spring training is not so much that he put together some like crazy spring that nobody expected. I think he sort of did what the Guardians expect him to do. I mean, obviously at another level, right? Like he was, as much as everyone's talking about Wyatt Langford's spring, like Chase DeLauter was right there with him for the most part. But I think that the Guardians, like, I think that's how they view him, is he's been that good when he's played. And so it's a matter of how healthy can he be? And I don't think they're going to wait as long as people expect them to. In part, I think, and maybe this is just me sort of wishful thinking, but like when you have a guy who has injury issues like this, and I'm starting to feel this way more and more about pitchers, just call them up. Call them up as soon as you can. Because if they're going to get hurt, like at least get, see what they can do, get value from them. Like, I don't know. So I'm hopeful that they're going to get him up in the first half of the season. And like I said, it's not that Straw being gone now means there's room for DeLotta or room for Manzardo, but it suggests something about what the Guardians are thinking about right now in terms of like, you know, Straw is the kind of guy who's like a really nice guy to have at the end of your roster. If you're a good team and could use a defensive replacement and pinch runner, like, great. They are not interested in that. They would rather see what they have in maybe Davis and De Los Santos. It seems like Esteban Florial. They're going to give Tyler Freeman a shot in center field. Like, they are experimenting right now. And as those experiments fail or pass, whatever happens, there will be opportunities for guys like DeLotta and Manzardo sooner than I think I had anticipated a few months ago.
I was trying to look up like what Guardians prospects, like how many plate appearances did they have at AA or AAA before getting called up? And I think you'd have a better idea than me. I mean, I looked up Bo Naylor and Stephen Kwan, and both of them, they didn't have a ton of experience at AA or AAA, but it was enough where, you know, they clearly wanted them to get a little bit more seasoned before calling them up. Now, maybe the need wasn't there. Neither of those two are even close to the level of prospect that Chase DeLotta is. But I'm just curious, is there in this regime's history, is there any other prospect that got called up so quickly? Because he does have a startlingly low number of plate appearances.
So, I mean, it's been a little while, but like that was Jose Ramirez. Right. He got called up and Jose Ramirez, unlike DeLotta, like he got called up and he was like, who is this like random little slap hitting guy? Like he wasn't touted the same way. And the organization was just like, he's ready and he's good and he's coming up. So I think like that's one example. They moved pretty quick with Oscar Gonzalez before he, you know, sort of fell apart. I'll look up. I'm not actually sure exactly how many plate appearances he had in the high minors. Let me see if I can find that real quick.
So Ramirez did have at least, Ramirez did have 533 plate appearances at AA. So, but again, a different caliber of prospect, right? I think that's important context here because,
yeah,
if Ramirez was just
the reality is,
it wouldn't have been so long.
Yeah, they don't have, they haven't had a prospect like that from a bat. From the offensive side of things, in a little while, like it's sure. Just right. I mean, it's a hard comparison. I will say I have heard repeatedly that they don't view AAA as a level that players need to face. Like AAA is where you hold players until you need them. AA is the level they need to conquer to show they're major league ready. I don't know. Has DeLotta conquered AA? I mean, not really. He only has 28 plate appearances there. But does that 28 plate appearances plus the fall league plus spring plus a month to start this season, does that look like enough? And I don't know. We'll see what happens with him. But I think he can move. I think he could move quickly. They've moved quickly with pitchers in the past. But they have a different relationship with their pitchers. So, yeah. Anyways, we're over an hour now, and I think we've covered a lot of the news and stuff we wanted to cover. Any last things you want to mention, or are we good for another week?
I think we might be good for another week. I mean, there's got to be some more, I guess, roster spots to kind of be filled here for teams. I can't think of any situations that are still up for debate that would have real fantasy implications. I mentioned Houken Whitlock getting rotation spots, so I'm going after them. But otherwise, I think it's watch that Milwaukee closer situation. I guess I don't really know what storylines are left to dissect outside of those guys.
Well, by the time we talk again, by the way, I think I said earlier that we were talking on Sunday. It's Saturday. We're talking on Saturday. This will come out Wednesday morning. By the time you hear from us again after this, every team will have played a handful of games. and that will be very exciting.
How exciting!
I have to figure out the schedule, but your Red Sox are here in Seattle opening night, and I'm intending to go to that game. And as soon as Boston leaves, Cleveland is here next. And so,
nice.
I'm hopefully going to be at 3-4 of the first six games, something like that, because I'm going to go to opening night, and I would like to go see my Guardians a few times, and we'll see how that plays out. But got to work it around all the kids stuff, see if I can 100%. Actually make it to those games. So, all right. Well, thank you all for listening. We'll be back with you next week.